Hello and welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are shifting gears significantly.
We certainly are.
Usually, we take a broad, somewhat narrative look at a topic, but today we have a very specific tactical mission. We are constructing a comprehensive, rigorous audio study guide designed specifically for first-year university economics students.
That is correct. And because of that specific target audience, you'll find the tone of this conversation will be quite different from our standard fare. We are going to be formal.
Right.
We are going to be rigorous. We are avoiding hyperbole and, you know, broad generalizations. The goal here is clarity, methodological precision, and understanding exactly how to implement and interpret the statistical tools found in Chapter 17 of A. Colin Cameron's Analysis of Economics Data.
Right. So if you are listening to this, you likely have your finals coming up, or perhaps you're staring at a problem set trying to wrap your head around special topics in econometrics. We are going to walk through this systematically, section by section. We are looking at source material that covers cross-section data, panel data, a really fascinating case study involving the NBA.
A very good one, yes.
Instrumental variables, causal inference frameworks, nonlinear regression, and finally, a quick checklist for time series analysis.
Exactly. It is a dense chapter because it effectively serves as a bridge. You have likely spent the majority of your semester learning ordinary least squares, or simple OLS.
The workhorse model.
The workhorse, exactly. No. Chapter 17 is the moment where we acknowledge that the real world is messy. Data does not always behave the way simple OLS assumptions require. We have clustered errors, we have endogeneity, we have binary outcomes.
All the problems.
All the interesting problems. And our mission today is to strictly define these problems and, more importantly, operationalize the solutions so you can use them.
Operationalize is the key word there. We want to get into the how-to.
The how-to, yes.
So let's unpack the roadmap before we begin. We are going to start with the structure of errors, specifically in cross-section and panel data.
A crucial starting point.
Then we will apply that framework to the MBA revenue data to see how different models, well, how they change the empirical results.
And they really do.
Then we tackle the big monster of econometrics, endogeneity, and how instrumental variables, or IV, can solve it.
Can attempt to solve it.
A very important distinction. Then we look at the causal inference frameworks, things like diff and diff and regression discontinuity.
The modern toolkit.
And finally, we will look at what happens when your dependent variable isn't a continuous number, you know, when it's something like a simple yes or no.
A solid plan. Let us begin immediately with section one, special issues with cross-section data.
Okay, let's dive in. When we talk about cross-section data in this specific context, the text flags the issue of clustered errors. Now, usually when I think of cross-section data, I think of a snapshot data at one point in time. Can you define the specific data structure we are dealing with here?
Certainly. In standard OLS, the foundational assumption, one of them anyway, is that every observation is independent.
Right.
That means the error term, the U for one person, is completely unrelated to the error term of another. But often, data comes in groups, or what we call clusters.
Okay, so individuals are nested within a larger group.
Precisely. Let's say we are looking at individuals which we can denote with the subscript dollars, but these individuals belong to a specific group, denoted by the subscript dollars.
So notation-wise, we are looking at variables indexed by both one and dollars.
Correct. The model is defined as beta 1 plus beta 2 by 2 plus ui. Here, that little jala represents the cluster. In an economic context, this could be students in a classroom, residents within a specific state, or firms operating within a specific industry.
And the problem arises because people in the same cluster tend to be similar.
Yeah.
Right? If I am in the same classroom as you, our test scores might be correlated because we share the same teacher. Oh. Or perhaps the same distraction, like a noisy radiator in the back of the room.
Precisely. That shared environment, that common shock, violates the independent errors assumption. If the errors are correlated within that cluster dollars, then the standard errors that your basic OLS regression spits out will be wrong.
Wrong in what way? Too big, too small?
Specifically, they will usually be too small. This is a critical point for any exam.
Okay.
Because they're too small, this leads to artificially inflated t-statistics, which in turn causes you to think a result is statistically significant when it's actually not. You're finding spurious results.
So you're overstating your confidence. You think you found something real, but it could just be noise amplified by this clustering problem.
That is a perfect way to put it. Now, the source material outlines three methodological steps or options for estimation to handle this.
Let's walk through those methods in detail. Method A seems to be the most direct fix, often called the robust approach.
Method A is, in many ways, the simplest. You're simply using OLS, but adjusting the standard errors after the fact. We call this OLS with cluster-robust standard errors.
Okay, so what does that mean in practice? What am I actually doing?
You run the standard regression model, your usual OLS. But when you calculate the precision of your estimates, the standard errors, you tell your statistical software, hey, my observations are not independent. They are clustered at the level of D dollars.
And the software knows how to make that correction.
It does. It uses a formula, often called a sandwich estimator, to adjust the variance-covariance matrix to account for that within group correlation.
So mechanically, you are not changing the slope of the line. The beta coefficients themselves remain the same.
Correct. And that's another crucial point. The point estimates, the betas do not change at all. It's the same line of best fit. However, the confidence intervals around those point estimates usually widen.
Which reflects our increased uncertainty.
Exactly. This is often the default fix in applied work because it corrects the inference, your hypothesis testing, without requiring you to make a major change to the underlying model structure. It's robust.
Okay, so that's the robust approach, method A. But then we have method B, which involves cluster-specific random effects. This feels a bit more structural. We're actually changing how we write the error term itself.
We are. This is where we stop treating the error as just one big blob of noise and we start modeling its components. In the random effects model, which is typically estimated via FGLS or feasible generalized least squares.
A bit of a mouthful.
It is. In that model, we assume the error term UDI has two distinct parts. We write it as OLFAG plus VEREPSILON I.
Let's break down those Greek letters. What are OLFAG and VEREPSILON?
Okay, so OLFAG is the group effect. Think of it as a random variable specific to the group. Every single individual in group dollars shares the same alpha. It's the noisy radiator from your example. We assume it has a mean of zero and some variance, say sigma alpha.
And the other piece, the epsilon.
The second term, VEREPSILON, is the individual specific error. This is the idiosyncratic noise, the stuff that's unique to person-allers within group dollars.
So we have separated the error into group stuff and individual stuff. What is the critical assumption we have to make for this model to work?
The assumption is paramount for the validity of this model, and it's a strong one. In random effects, you must assume that alphage, that group effect, is treated as a random variable that is uncorrelated with the regressors, with your $6 variables.
Hmm. That sounds restrictive. Can you give an example of where that would be violated?
Of course. But let's stick with the classroom example. Imagine our regressor, our $6, is hours spent studying, and our outcome is the exam score. The group effect, alphage, could represent teacher quality.
Okay.
The random effects assumption says that teacher quality must be uncorrelated with how many hours students study. But is that realistic? Probably not. Better teachers might inspire students to study more.
Right. So the unobserved group characteristics would be related to the independent variables.
Exactly. And if that's the case, if that correlation exists, the random effects model will be inconsistent. It will give you biased beta coefficients.
So why would we ever use it? What is the benefit of doing this over just using the robust errors from method A?
Efficiency. That's the one word answer. Because FGLS explicitly models the error structure if, and this is a big if the model assumptions hold true, meaning AlphaGiti really is uncorrelated with $6, then it can be more efficient than OLS.
And by more efficient, you mean?
You will get smaller standard errors and more precise estimates. You have more statistical power because you've used more information about how the data was generated.
So it's a trade-off. You make a strong assumption, and if you're right, you get a better estimate. But if you're wrong, your estimate is biased.
That is the fundamental trade-off. Which brings us to method C, cluster-specific fixed effects. This is often positioned as the more robust alternative to random effects, specifically for when we suspect that correlation.
So this is our solution when we think teacher quality is correlated with study hours.
Precisely. Now, how does the model change here? In fixed effects, we still have that error term decomposition, 1 alphag plus VEREPSILON. But we treat alphag very differently. We don't assume it's a random variable. We treat it as an individual-specific fixed parameter.
What does that mean, a fixed parameter?
It means that basically every group dollars effectively gets its own intercept. It's like we're saying classroom A has its own baseline level of performance and classroom B has its own different baseline.
But if we have a data set with 1,000 groups, say 1,000 different classrooms, we cannot estimate 1,000 intercepts. We would run out of degrees of freedom.
You're exactly right. We cannot estimate them directly, nor do we usually care about the specific value of each classroom's intercept. So instead, we perform a clever transformation to eliminate LFOG entirely from the equation.
And this is what's called the within transformation.
Correct. We do this by subtracting the group mean from every individual observation.
Let's walk through that math step by step so the listener can really visualize the equation.
Okay. Start with the dependent variable, $9. For each group dollars, we calculate the average of Yawler for just that group. We'll denote that bar G.
The group mean.
The group mean.
Okay.
Then, for every single observation in the data set, we calculate the difference. Bar G, we've demeaned the variable.
And we do that for everything.
We do the exact same thing for all the regressors, $6 G. And critically, the same logic applies to the error term.
So the entire equation becomes the difference from the mean.
Correct. The estimated equation is now beta plus var epsilon-y plus var epsilon-ing dollars. Now here's the magic. Consider that group effect, all for dollars. Since alphan is constant for everyone in group dollars, what is the group mean of alphaja?
Well, if it's a constant, the average is just itself, so alphaja.
Precisely. So when we subtract the mean, we get alphic alphan g, which equals zero.
It vanishes. We have mathematically deleted the group effect.
Exactly. And this leads to what the text calls the key interpretation distinction. Because alphag is gone, the fixed effects estimator allows the regressors, the $6 variables, to be correlated with that group effect alpha gone.
Ah, that is the aha moment. In random effects, we had to assume independence. It was a very strong, often unbelievable assumption.
It was.
In fixed effects, we don't care if the group effect is correlated with $6 because we've wiped it out of the equation.
Precisely. If group quality or teacher ability is correlated with your independent variable, fixed effects controls for it by design. Inconsistency in this model would only arise if the regressors are correlated with the remaining part of the error, the idiosyncratic var epsilon-y.
That is a crucial distinction and a massive advantage for fixed effects in many applied settings. It buys you robustness against a whole class of omitted variables, specifically any unobserved variable that is constant within the group.
Correct.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's transition from groups to time. Section 2 deals with the mechanics of panel data.
The logic here is very, very similar, but the notation and the context change slightly. Instead of groups, which we call G-dollar, we now have individuals observed over time periods, T-doll up to $2.
So our data is defined by two dimensions, person, R, and year, $2.
Exactly. But before we get to the estimation methods, which will look very familiar, the text breaks down how variables actually vary in panel data. This decomposition of variation concept is really important.
Why is it so fundamental?
Because it dictates which models you can use and what kinds of questions you can answer. Consider a variable, let's call it ZIA, like income for person $80 and year to Moyers. We can break its total variation into three distinct concepts.
Okay, what's the first one?
First, there's total variation. This is just the standard variation you'd calculate if you ignored the panel structure. It's the variation of every observation around the overall grand mean of the entire data set.
Okay, that's the baseline, simple variance.
Then we have within variation. This is the variation over time for a specific individual. You calculate it as the variation of Zauer around that individual's own personal mean.
So an example would be?
Think of it as how much a person's income changes from year to year relative to their own average lifetime income. It is the history of the individual. How much do they fluctuate around their own personal trend?
Got it. And the third type of variation.
That's the between variation. This is the variation of the individual means. The bars are across the entire population around the overall mean.
So this captures how much richer person A is compared to person B on average across their lives.
A perfect summary. Within is me versus me over time, and between is me versus you.
And this decomposition has major statistical implications.
It does. Here is the key takeaway. OLS and random effects estimators utilize both within and between variation. They look at the whole picture. They use information on how you change over time and also on how you compare to others.
But fixed effects is different.
Fixed effects is completely different. The fixed effects estimator uses only within variation.
Because we subtracted the means.
Exactly. When we do the within transformation, Mari, we are literally removing the individual average from every single variable. We are throwing away the between variation to focus exclusively on how changes in $6 over time for a person relate to changes in $9 over time for that same person.
So methodologically, the steps for panel estimation are going to directly parallel the cross-section steps we just discussed.
They do, almost one for one. Step one is your basic pooled OLS, but with cluster robust standard errors, this time clustered on the individual dollars.
To account for the fact that my error term this year is probably related to my error term last year.
Correct. Step two is random effects, again using FGLS, which models the correlation over time, but relies on that strong assumption of independence between the individual effect and the regressors.
And step three is the big one, fixed effects.
Step three is fixed effects, using that exact same within transformation. And again, the primary advantage is that it provides a consistent estimation, even if your regressors are correlated with any time invariant characteristics of the individual, which we now call affiché.
Things like innate ability, or your family background, or your gender, things that don't change over time.
All those get wiped out by the transformation.
Okay, this is all a bit abstract. To make this concrete, the source material provides a really detailed case study. Let's move to section three. The NBA team revenue case study. This is where we see these methods fight it out in the real world.
It's an excellent example. The data set is simply called NBA. It covers 29 teams over 10 seasons, running from the 2001 season to the 2011 season. This is what we call a short panel.
What does short panel mean?
It means that $2, the number of time periods, is fixed and relatively small, in this case, 10 years. While another, the number of individuals or teams, is larger, 29 teams. This is a common structure in economics.
And the goal of the analysis is to explain team revenue. So the dependent variable, the dollars, is ELN revenue, the natural log of revenue.
Correct. Using the log means our coefficients will have a percentage interpretation, which is convenient. And the regressors, the six ELN variables, include wins, the number of wins in a season, playoff, a binary variable, that's one if they made the playoffs, champion, binary for winning it all, all-stars, the number of players voted as all-stars, and El City Pop, the log of the city population.
Now, before running a single regression, the text does something very smart. It analyzes the variation of these variables, breaking it down into, within, and between.
Yes, and this is a critical diagnostic step for anyone using panel data. It helps you predict how the fixed effects model is going to behave.
What does it show?
Well, the text notes that the variable TEAMID obviously has zero. Within variation, a team's ID doesn't change over time. But look at a more interesting variable, ELN City Pop, the log of city population. It has an overall standard deviation, of course, but the within standard deviation is very low, only 0.097 compared to the between standard deviation of 0.807.
Which makes perfect sense when you think about it. Chicago's population is much bigger than, say, Milwaukee's. That's the large between variation.
Right.
But Chicago's population doesn't actually change that much from 2001 to 2011. There's not much year-to-year fluctuation. That's the tiny within variation.
Exactly. Most of the action in the population data is between cities, not within a city over a decade. Keep that in mind. It's going to come very important. Now, let's look at the regression results.
Okay, we are comparing the different models and specifically focusing on the slope coefficient for the wins variable. What does the first model, pooled OLS, tell us?
In the simple pooled OLS model, the coefficient for wins is 0.00049, and it's highly statistically significant. This suggests a strong positive relationship.
How do we interpret that 0.0049?
Since the dependent variable is in logs, we can say that, roughly, one extra win in a season corresponds to a 0.49% increase in team revenue.
Okay, sounds plausible. But now what happens when we run the fixed effects model?
When we run the fixed effects model, the coefficient on wins drops substantially down to 0.00027. It's still statistically significant, but it's almost half the size of the OLS estimate.
Wow. So in the fixed effects model, one additional win is associated with only a 0.27% increase in team revenue. Why did it drop so much compared to OLS? What's the story here?
The expert interpretation, and the one students should focus on, is that the OLS model was likely suffering from omitted variable bias.
Caused by those time invariant characteristics, the alpha.
Exactly. Think about it. Better teams might be located in cities with more passionate fan bases, or they might have stronger, more valuable brands, things like being the Lakers or the Celtics. These are characteristics that are unobserved in the data, but are time invariant.
And these characteristics are probably correlated with winning.
Of course. A better brand helps you attract better players, which leads to more wins. OLS sees that correlation between the unobserved brand value and wins, and it wrongly attributes all of that effect to the wins themselves. It inflates the coefficient.
The fixed effects?
Fixed effects strips out the alpha. It controls for the fact that the Lakers are the Lakers every single year. It isolates the pure effect of a win on revenue within a team's own history.
So the 0.00027 is likely the more truthful, or at least more causally interpretable, estimate of the effect of winning, conditional on the team's fixed characteristics.
That is the argument, yes.
Yeah.
It's considered a more reliable estimate. But now, let's look at that Ellen City Pop anomaly. This is the cautionary tale of fixed effects.
Right. What happens to the coefficient on log city population in the fixed effects model?
It's a disaster. In the fixed effects model, the coefficient for log city population actually flips sign and becomes negative, and it's statistically insignificant. It's effectively unreliable noise.
Wait, hold on. So the model is saying that being in a bigger city leads to less revenue. That doesn't make any economic sense.
It's a pure statistical artifact. Remember our discussion about variation. Fixed effects relies exclusively on within variation.
And we established that city population has almost no within variation.
Exactly. When you subtract the mean from a variable that barely changes over 10 years, what are you left with? Mostly measurement error and tiny, meaningless fluctuations. The fixed effects transformation completely removed the between variation, which is where the real positive relationship between population and revenue lives.
That is a huge takeaway for students. Fixed effects is great for controlling for unobserved heterogeneity. But it is terrible for estimating the effects of any variables that don't change much over time.
Correct. If all the interesting variation in your key variable is between, fixed effects will kill your signal and leave you with just noise. You simply cannot use it to answer questions about slow-moving variables.
Okay, that's a fantastic practical lesson. We've dealt with error structures. Now let's move to section 4, and one of the most famous and perhaps most difficult tools in the Economist's toolkit, instrumental variables, or IV.
IV is a powerful technique, but it's designed to solve a very specific problem, endogeneity.
Let's define that carefully.
Okay. We start with our simple model. DLA equals beta 1 plus beta 2 x plus u. The problem is that OLS has a core assumption that the correlation between the regressor $6 and the error term ua is zero. If that assumption is violated, if u neck, then we say that $6 is endogenous.
And if $6 is endogenous, what's the consequence for OLS?
The consequence is catastrophic. OLS becomes inconsistent, and that's a technical term, meaning that the estimate will not converge to the true parameter value, even if you had an infinite amount of data. It's fundamentally biased.
So if $6 is contaminated by being mixed up with the error term, we need a clean, uncontaminated way to measure its effect. Enter the instrument, which we call SUGO.
That's the idea. The definition of a solution, an instrumental variable, requires a variable, wool zero, that satisfies two incredibly strict conditions.
What's the first one?
First, the exclusion restriction. This means that the zero does not belong in the original model for y'all. It has no direct effect on the outcome variable. Its only pathway to influencing that is through $6.
Okay, so zero can't have its own separate effect on the outcome. And the second condition?
Second is relevance. This one is easier to check. It just means that zero must be correlated with the endogenous variable, $6. If it's not, it's irrelevant and useless as an instrument.
So, to summarize, zero affects six, and $6 affects, but zero does not affect your directly. It only works through $6. It's like a puppet master pulling the strings of $6.
A very good analogy. If, and again, a huge if those conditions are met, we can calculate the IV estimator, which we denote as BIVDO. The formula is distinct from OLS. It is the sample covariance of zero and alls divided by the sample covariance of zero and six.
The formula in the book is BIV fraxims. That can look a little intimidating.
It can, but the text gives a really intuitive logic for this using a ratio of changes idea. Can I walk you through that?
Please do. The numerical analogies are always the most helpful.
Okay. Think of it as a chain reaction. Intuitively, the IV estimator is calculating the effect of $6 on Ni, delta E delta, as a ratio of two other effects. The effect of Z on ABC delta divided by the effect of Z on 6 on Z, EC on 6, 8.
So the reduced form effect divided by the first stage effect.
Exactly, using the jargon. Let's use numbers. Suppose a one unit change in our instrument, Z is associated with a two-unit increase in our endogenous variable, $6.
Okay, Zia moves, it'll be $2.
And suppose we also find that that same one-unit change in the level is associated with a three-unit increase in our outcome.
So C moves by three.
Now, here's the leap of faith from the exclusion restriction. Since we assume Cijo only affects AOD through its effect on $6, we can infer that those two units of $6 must have been what caused the three-unit change in the A.
Oh, okay.
Therefore, the causal effect of just one unit of $6 on Ye must be that ratio, $3 equals $1.555. That is the fundamental logic of I.
That makes it so much clearer. It's using the part of the variation in $6 that is exogenously moved by Saddle to figure out the true effect.
That's the perfect technical description. The classic example provided to illustrate this is the log wage model. Yes, a staple of any econometrics course. We want to know the effect of schooling on later life wages.
And the endogeneity problem is?
The endogeneity problem is ability. People with high innate ability, which is unobserved and therefore in the error term over 100, tend to both get more schooling and earn more money regardless of their schooling. So ability is correlated with both $6 and yay. OLS will overestimate the true causal return to schooling.
It mistakes the effect of ability for the effect of schooling. So we need an instrument for schooling.
A common one proposed in the literature is distance to the closest college. Let's check the conditions.
Okay, condition one. Relevance.
Does living closer to a college affect your years of schooling? Yes, on average. So it's correlated with six boils. Relevance is met.
Condition two, the exclusion restriction.
This is the tricky one. Does living near a college in and of itself make you earn more money directly, holding schooling constant? The argument is no. It doesn't magically make you a higher wage worker. It only raises your wages by making it easier and cheaper for you to get more education.
Of course, in the real world, finding a perfect instrument is incredibly difficult, and people can argue all day about whether the exclusion restriction holds.
It is the hardest part of applied microeconomics, but that's the theory. This search for causality leads us perfectly into section five, causal inference frameworks. Four is just one way to try and get at causality. The text outlines a broader menu of methods.
Right, because the world isn't full of randomized controlled trials.
Unfortunately not. The overarching goal here is obtaining a causal estimate of $6 on Ivirai using observational data and specifically handling the issue of self-selection. People choose whether to get more schooling or take a job training program. They aren't randomly assigned.
And the text grounds this whole discussion in the Rubin causal model, which is also called the potential outcomes framework.
Yes, this is a very important vocabulary shift for students. We stop talking only about regression coefficients and start talking about potential outcomes.
How'd that work?
Let's imagine a binary treatment, which we'll call DEDL. It can be zero or one. You either took the program or you didn't. The framework says that for every single individual NG dollar, there are two potential outcomes. 1D, which is the outcome they would have if they got the treatment.
And why?
The outcome they would have if they did not get the treatment.
But the text calls out the fundamental problem of causal inference.
Which is that we can't observe both for the same person. I can't take the medicine and not take the medicine at the same time to see the difference in my health. We only ever observe one of the two potential outcomes. The other is a counterfactual.
It's what would have been.
Exactly. So we have to rely on averages across groups of people to try and estimate these effects. We define the ADE, the average treatment effect, as the expected difference, EYYE, across the whole population.
And there's another one, the ATE.
Yes, the average treatment effect on the treated. This focuses specifically on the group that actually received the treatment. It asks, for the people who took this program, what was the effect for them? It's often a more relevant policy question.
So how do we estimate these counterfactuals with observational data? The text lists four key methodologies. Let's go through them one by one. Methodology one is differences in differences, or diff and diff.
Diff and diff is a very popular and intuitive method, often considered a natural experiment. The ideal setup requires two time periods and two groups of people.
The treated and the control.
Right. In period one, before anything happens, no one is treated. Then, between period one and period two, something changes, and one group gets the treatment while the other does not.
And the calculation is literally in the name.
It is. You calculate the first difference, the average change in the outcome over time for the treated group. Then you calculate the second difference, the average change in the untreated control group. The diff and diff estimate is simply the difference between those two changes.
So you're using the control group to figure out what the background trend was.
Exactly. You subtract out the trend that would have affected the treatment group anyway, even if they hadn't been treated. The core assumption is that those trends would have been parallel in the absence of the treatment.
Okay, that makes sense. Methodology two is regression discontinuity design, or RDD.
Yeah.
This one feels very visual, very graphical.
It is. It relies on a threshold.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose there is some continuous variable. Let's call it the Sollers, like a test score. And the rule is if you score above 100 on this test, you get the treatment. If you score below 100, you don't.
So simply being on one side of that line or the other determines your fate.
Correct. The logic of RDD is that individuals who are just below the cutoff, say with a score of 99.5, and individuals who are just above the cutoff, say 100.5, are essentially identical in every other way. They're basically clones. The only meaningful difference between them is that one got the treatment and the other didn't.
So you can just compare them.
You compare the average outcome for people just above the threshold to the average view for people just below it. The jump or discontinuity in the outcome right at that threshold is your estimate of the treatment effect.
The text shows a model for this. Yi, DBEL1 plus gamma D plus beta 2 C plus Wei. The key parameter is gamma.
Yes, the coefficient gamma on the treatment dummy literally measures the size of that jump at the cutoff. It's a very powerful and credible local estimator of causality.
Okay. Methodology 3 brings us back to our friend IV, but with a specific and important twist. Local average treatment effects, or LATE. This deals with heterogeneous effects.
Right. This framework acknowledges that a treatment or a policy doesn't affect everyone in the same way. When we use an instrument as a dollar to encourage people to take a treatment dollar, people will respond differently.
And the text introduces a whole taxonomy of individuals.
Yes, this is a key concept. Relative to the instrument's dollar, we can classify people into four types. First, the always takers. They get the treatment no matter what the instrument says.
Right.
Second, the never takers. They never get the treatment, regardless of the instrument.
And the third group is the important one.
The third group is the compliers. These are the people who are induced to take the treatment only because of the instrument. They take it when Z$ is nettle and don't when Z$ is nullar. They comply with the instrument.
And the fourth type?
The fourth type is defiers. These are perverse individuals who would do the opposite of the instrument. They take the treatment only when they're not encouraged to.
And we have to make a crucial assumption about them called monotonicity, right?
Yes. For the late interpretation to hold, we must assume there are no defiers. It's a pretty reasonable assumption in most settings.
So if that holds, what does IV actually estimate?
This is the punchline. The IV estimator does not estimate the average treatment effect for everyone. It identifies the treatment effect specifically and only for the compliers.
Wow.
It tells us the effect on that group of people who were induced to change their behavior by the instrument. It says absolutely nothing about the effect for the always takers or the never takers. That's why it's called a local average treatment effect.
That is a much more nuanced interpretation than we started with. Finally, methodology 4, IPW and matching.
These are two related methods. IPW stands for inverse probability weighting. The first step is to calculate a propensity score for each person. Mm. This is just the predicted probability of them being treated based on their observable characteristics, their six-hour variables.
And once you have that probability, you use it to weight the data.
Exactly. You weight the treated observations by $1 ABLES by $1 stay it and the untreated observations by one under rule. The intuition is that this creates a synthetic, pseudo-randomized sample where the treatment and control groups look similar, at least on the characteristics you observed.
And matching.
Matching is a similar idea, but more direct. For each treated person, it tries to find one or more nearest neighbors from the untreated group who have very similar six-seller values, and then it compares their outcomes directly. Both of these methods rely heavily on the assumption that you observed all the important confounding variables.
Okay, that covers the main causal inference tools. Now let's tackle section 6, nonlinear regression models. This is for when our outcome variable, dollars, isn't a nice continuous number like revenue, but something like a binary 0 or 1.
Correct. When U is binary, did you buy the product or not? Did you default on the loan or not? Standard OLS is problematic. Its predictions can go above 1 or below 0, which makes no sense for a probability. So we turn to logit and probit models.
What's the difference between them?
They are very similar in practice. The main difference is the function they use to squeeze the predicted probability to lie between 0 and 1. Logit uses the exponential or logistic function. Probit uses the cumulative distribution function, or CDF, of the standard normal distribution, which is often denoted by the capital Greek letter phi.
Now, here's the warning for every student listening. The part to highlight in your notes, interpreting the coefficients.
This is where so many points are lost on exams. In OLS, the beta coefficient is the marginal effect. It's easy. In logit and probit, the coefficient beta-beta is not the marginal effect.
Say that one more time.
The beta you see in the output is not the marginal effect. It is just a parameter that lives inside a nonlinear function. You cannot say a one-unit increase in X leads to a beta increase in the probability of Y. That is wrong.
So how do we interpret it? What can we say? The text gives us some useful rules of thumb for the marginal effect, or ME.
Yes, these are very handy for quick interpretation. For the logit model, the rule is the marginal effect of a variable 6j drill is roughly less than or equal to bujee 5 times the absolute value of its coefficient bj. So mej luck 0.25 times bj Euler.
And for probit?
For probit, the scalar is 0.4. So the marginal effect is bounded above by Ebsop force sorth 4 out times the absolute value of the coefficient, mej luck 0.4 times bj goal.
And in both cases, the sign of the coefficient bj tells you the sign of the effect, right?
Yes, that part is direct. A positive beta means a positive marginal effect, so you can always check the direction, and you can use those multipliers to get a rough upper bound on the magnitude of the effect.
Okay. The text also briefly mentions exponential mean models. What are those for?
These are for non-negative data, often count data like number of doctor visits or financial data like wages, which can't be negative. The formula looks like A of X plus X pay plus beta 1 plus sec plus a k doll.
So the conditional mean is an exponential function. And how do we estimate and interpret that?
We estimate it using a method called quasi-maximum likelihood, or QMLE, not with least squares. The interpretation is actually much cleaner here than in logit probit. The coefficients of J dollar act as semi-elasticities. A one-unit change in 6J dollar leads to roughly a $100 times BJ dollar percent change in COPE lackers.
And the average marginal effect?
The average marginal effect has a very simple formula. It's just the mean of Ni times the coefficient times BJ dollar.
We are in the home stretch now. Let's briefly cover Section 7, Time Series Overview. The host notes here state that the source material is very dense and acts more like a checklist than a deep explanation.
That's a fair assessment. For this particular chapter, students should treat this final section as a vocabulary list of topics they need to be familiar with for a future, more advanced course.
What's on the checklist?
First, HAC standard errors. This stands for heteroscedasticity and autocorrelation consistent errors. These are the time series equivalent of robust standard errors, and they are essential.
Okay, what's next?
Second, stationarity in unit roots. This is a huge topic. The basic idea is that if your data is non-stationary meaning, it wanders around without ever returning to a constant meaning. Your standard regressions can be completely misleading. You need to test for this.
Which leads to the third point.
Spurious regression. This is the classic example where you regress two variables that are both trending upwards over time, like, say, ice cream sales and shark attacks. They will look highly correlated in a regression, but the relationship is spurious. It's just driven by the common trend.
And the last item on the checklist.
Autoregressive models. These are models where you use lags of your dependent variable, Yalers, as regressors. So you're explaining $8 today with its value from yesterday.
And the dataset example provided for this section.
It's a dataset called Interest Rates. It contains monthly data from January 1982 to January 2015. The example involves regressing 10-year treasury note rates on one-year rates. This is a classic example of where you would absolutely need to check for unit roots and cointegration before you could trust your results.
So we have covered a massive amount of ground today. From fixing clustered errors, to the nuances of fixed effects and panel data, to the magic of instrumental variables, to the rigorous frameworks of causal inference, and finally these checklists for nonlinear and time series topics.
If we try to synthesize all of this, I think you can view Chapter 17 as a progression of sophistication or maybe a progression of intellectual honesty about our data.
How so?
We start by admitting that our errors have a structure we need to deal with, that's clustering and panel methods. Then we admit that our main variable of interest, $6, might be correlated with the error term $2, that's IV. Then we admit that just claiming causality from a regression coefficient is not enough. We need rigorous logical frameworks to even talk about causality. That's the Rubin model, diff and diff, RDD. And finally, we admit that our outcome variables themselves aren't always nice, continuous, linear things. And that leads us to logit and probit.
It really highlights that econometrics isn't just running a regression. It is about a deep and careful process of matching the model you choose to the actual data generation process.
Indeed. And here is a final provocative thought for the listener to take away as they study. In this world of observational data, are we ever truly observing causality, or are we just building more and more sophisticated models of correlation? We saw with the NBA data that simply switching from OLS to fixed effects cut the estimated effect of winning almost in half. a different choice. Maybe a clever AAV might have given a third completely different answer. The choice of the method, be it fixed effects or 5 or RDD, fundamentally changes the truth that we extract from the numbers.
The math gives you an answer.
The math always gives you an answer. But your understanding of the economic context, the data, and the deep assumptions behind your chosen method is what determines if it's the right answer.
That is a powerful and humbling place to end. The tools are powerful, but the user needs to be wise. Good luck with your finals, and we hope this deep dive helps you master Chapter 17. Go apply these steps to your next problem set.
Goodbye.
See you next time.